Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good day, everybody. Glad to have you aboard. And if you are with us live, which I would like to thank everybody who's not totally obsessed about the Super Bowl today. It doesn't start yet. You've got time for Midrats. So you brave souls that decide you need a little bit of a brain cleanser and get back to our favorite topic. We appreciate you joining us live. One of the great things I like about having you live is we're able to get feedback from you. So while we're doing the show, scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find a link to the chat room. And if you are so inclined, you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or even a question you would like for us to direct to our guest, if you put it there in the chat room, we'll be glad to pull it in. And I always like to do the altar call when I get a chance, and I don't forget that if you don't already, go over to iTunes, Spreaker, Spotify, wherever you aggregate your podcast, and go ahead and subscribe to Midrats, because maybe Sunday Live is not always convenient to you. That way, when you're doing your commute during the week, we'll be right there ready for you when you want to listen to us prattle on. But we're not going to prattle on today. We've got a great topic with a great guest. What we're going to look about is it's a regular conversation. Everybody likes talking about the vulnerabilities of aircraft carriers as if it's really anything new. It's really not. You can go back to the dawn of when aircraft carriers were first used in combat, and they are vulnerable, not just because of what they're designed to do, which is carry a bunch of thin-skinned airplanes full of fuel and bombs around, but it's because of what they can do. There are few assets that you can think of, especially in the last century, that a nation can project sovereign authority and power on a global scale at sea in the global commons than an aircraft carrier. As such, people who don't have that capability or even have a smaller version or an equal version, they're going to want to eliminate that capability because that's what best suits their needs if they decide they don't want Uncle Sam twirling around in their waters doing what he wants to do. And at peace and war, we see that. And even in the events in the Red Sea recently, again, the questions ask, where is the aircraft carrier? It's not so much where are the armored divisions. And when we look back at the great Pacific wars of the last century, whether World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, there are places where, especially towards the end of World War II, not so much in the beginning, which is what we're going to talk about, the aircraft carriers could operate pretty much at will and dominate most of the world oceans. And that history and that habit, especially for those that are Gen X and younger, we think that's our birthright since the fall of the Soviet Union. It's really not. That age, if it's not already, is going to be shutting its door any moment now. And we want to talk a little bit about that reality because it's a background I think is important for people to understand should the next great Pacific war come, that it's not going to be like other wars where you're used to just having our aircraft carriers and the air wings doing whatever they want, wherever they want. And we're going to bring on a returning guest today. Spot on. He's been doing a lot of the intellectual heavy lifting on this exact topic, and that is Dr. John T. Kuhn. He's a professor of military history at the Army Command and General Staff College in Leavenworth, Kansas. John, welcome back to Midrats this Sunday. It's great to have you aboard.
Hey, it's good to be here, Sal. Sorry about my barking dog. He's got a bark collar on, too, so I don't know. We might have to check our bark collar out.
We are a dog-friendly show. That just gives it that homey feel. I just introduced you, and regulars of Midrats, they've listened to us interview you before, but we've always got new listeners on board. And I've always found your job to be as interesting as it is important, because here you are, a retired U.S. Navy commander in the heart of the country, very far away from salt water, spending most of your time trudging around with Army guys in Kansas. And talk for a little bit about the staff college that you have there in Leavenworth, your role, and not just, you know, your specific role, but how you see yourself as one of the few Navy guys there that can perhaps broaden the horizon then for a lot of our developing leaders, mostly on the land component, but I know that you have a joint student body there.
Yeah. No, I came through here as a student back in the 90s. It was kind of one of those good deal secrets that kind of exist in the military for people in the Navy who wanted to kind of get access to the Midwest, which is hard to do in a Navy career. So I came through here, oh gosh, I came through here 24 years ago as a student, or no, more than 24 years, almost 28 years ago as a student, as part of, you know, the JPME1 piece, Joint Professional Military Education once. But once I got here, I liked it. There was a lot of military history here. I was a military history nut even back then. And then when I got an opportunity to come back here and teach, it was a joint billet to teach back here. And so I came back and taught here. So it's, you know, it was a great way to kind of get to the Midwest and also to kind of do military history stuff. Really great place to teach and everything. Really nice quality of life. The base here, they don't call it a base, they call it a post, but it's just really nice. And so I've been here for 24 years teaching, four on active duty and the rest as a civilian, Department of the Army civilian. So I've been actually in the Army now almost as long as I've been as I was in the Navy before I retired from the Navy. So pretty joint. It's a great job. I mean, we get approximately 1,200 students in every year to the Command and General Staff Officer course. And again, it's their, for the Army, it's their version of the Navy Command and Staff College out of Newport. And the top 50 in the Army come through here, and they pretty much do a good job sending that 50 here. Of course, they don't have to man ships at sea like we do. But, you know, for a time it was difficult for them to get through here because of the war on terror with the force gen and the rotational piece for force gen. And but they send their top 50 guys through here. And then all of our major allies and partners send their best officers here. So the cream of the crop from all the NATO countries, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and anywhere else that's actually a partner with the United States, including the Vietnamese, send their guys here. So they're here. And so you get to meet a lot of different people, a lot of different perspectives. And, of course, you're meeting the best that the Army has. You know, quite a number of these guys will go on to become generals, and you know, a couple of them will probably go all the way to the top, the four-star. The Navy has a requirement to send people here, the Air Force and the Marines. The Marines do the same thing that the Army does. They send their best guys here, and the Air Force does that. The only service that doesn't send their best people here is the Navy. The Navy basically sends, like, whoever they can. Once they get here, they realize it's a pretty good deal, but it's really hard for them to get people here unless you're like me. You know, I had a buddy who'd gone here, and he goes, hey, you like military history, this is the place for you. Yeah, you got to put up with some Army stuff, you know, learning some Army stuff here and there. But, and, you know, this is broadening as far as I was concerned. So I've been doing that for 20 years. I've been in the history department for that long. I got a joint job teaching the joint curriculum here, but I almost immediately transferred down to the history department because the guy who worked down there, who was the director, a guy named Dr. Jim Wilbanks, he and I were buddies, and he wanted to get me down there so I could finish my PhD and go to work for him. So that's how I did it, and I worked my way up. I've been a named professor here. I was the William Stoft Chair of Historical Research from 2013 to 2016. I'm a full professor now. I'm one of the gray beards around the department. I'm one of the most senior guys in the department. I used to be that new, young, you know, brand new historian, and now I'm the old, you know, fogey historian, you know, who you know can remember events that other people weren't even born during, you know. And so all that Cold War stuff that I did You know, I was telling my students the other day, you know, the year I turned 18 was the year that they eliminated the draft. And they look at me like, my God, you know, I tell them I'm a 20th century man. You've got a living relic of the past century here to teach you. So I've got lots of anecdotal stories and sea stories and stuff. So I love it. As long as I enjoy teaching the students, I think I'll keep doing it. I didn't lose you guys, did I?
No, I it's my turn to ask you a question, John, and I couldn't find my unmute button. So. Because I'm even older than you are. So it's one of those exciting adventures in live radio.
In your moment, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's got a little red light on it. You think I'd be able to spot it right away? But, you know, I'm not a naval aviator, so I usually have a long time to think about these things. Let's talk a little bit about your book that I think came out in October of last year, Strategy in Crisis. Talk a little bit about that and the lessons we can learn from World War II that may be, this is a broad topic, but may be applicable to what's going on in East Asia right now.
Yeah, so the book actually began during COVID. I was at the Naval War College as the Ernest King professor there, visiting professor. So I was there during the COVID year. And I always tell people I eventually came back here because they never opened the college back up so I could actually teach for them from my basement. But while I was there, I met this guy named Mike Pavkovic. Mike's an old friend. And he was doing a new series for the Naval Institute called The Essentials of Strategy, right? And he goes, hey, we'd like to get you to do a book for us in this new series. So as it turned out, this is the inaugural book in the Essentials of Strategy series. And I looked at the Pacific War, 1937 to 1945. And I started it in 1937 because that's when the war really started. It started in China and in 1937 in North China at the Marco Polo Bridge. And then it rapidly spread throughout China with this massive battle in Shanghai in 1937 that was a World War II kind of battle, you know, with machine guns, tanks, a naval aircraft bombing targets ashore, you know, over a million combatants and just this amazing thing. So I agreed to do it. The book looks at all of the aspects of that war, World War II in the Pacific, in eight concise chapters. So it's a one-stop shopping book. I kind of modeled it on Ron Spector's Eagle Against the Sun. I wanted to kind of have that sort of a feel to it, but to sort of take a fresh look at that. And so the title was not my title. Naval Institute kind of picked it out for me, Strategy in Crisis. My title was, you know, World War II in the Pacific, you know, kind of, you know, here it is, you know, generic Wheaties or something, you know, but they wanted it to be, you know, something sexy. So I did that book. And so the book is really looks at the operational and strategic level of World War II. I don't get into the tactics very much at all. But when they changed the funny story that I want to tell you guys here, and you might give me a chance to kind of riff on this is that when they said, okay, well, we want you to title the book Strategy in Crisis, and I said, well, heck, you know, people are gonna want their money back because I don't really, you know, kind of go into strategy in crisis. I kind of tell you about the strategies that the Japanese, the Americans, the Chinese, the British, the Netherlands, France, all these different actors are trying to implement both prior to the war and then as the crisis deepens and war breaks out in China. But I don't really have a thread of strategy in crisis throughout the book. So maybe I should write an epilogue, you know, to kind of explain why it's strategy in crisis. It's more narrative than argument.
If the narrative is, and we talked about this in the pre-show a bit, but just for the listeners, kind of the impetus to invite John to come back on here is I just was having, again, one of my little moments where I was getting a little frustrated with some of the conversations about future conflict west of the international dateline and aircraft carriers and vulnerability, because it's I remember back, it was a cover of The Atlantic back in, I think, 1987. I was in college at the time that I saw that had the U.S. Navy as sitting ducks. I mean, this is not a new line of argument. And I think a lot of people find or think this is a new thing that they've discovered when it's just the opposite. This has always been true for some of the reasons that I said in the introduction. And John kind of popped me a DM, and he's like, hey, you know, I've written a book that kind of covers on this. And as I look, come on and bring it on, because I think it's a really important part of because a lot of people, they're not so much reinventing the wheel, is they're getting the first blush of thinking about something that they really should be on the fourth or fifth iteration trying to pick up the details on. And I liked one of the, maybe it's because you've been around a bunch of Army guys here, but in chapter two of your book, Strategy in Crisis, I like the title that you use, which was Oceanic Blitzkrieg, in the fact that as one of my favorite, but also one of my frustrating pictures of World War II is the famous one, I think it's at Ufili Atoll, Murderer's Row, that has all these Essex-class carriers, plus I think the Enterprise, lined up in a row with this huge fleet around them. And that really did not represent that first 15 months of the war from 19, you know, the way I would like to draw the line is from Pearl Harbor up to about March of 43. It's a very different war. It was very much the come-as-you-are war that we would face if we have something in the Western Pacific showing up in the next 10 years. If you could for a second, you know, talk for a little bit, the cold water in the face of what the Imperial Japanese Navy was able to do in the Western Pacific with their interior and exterior lines of communication. The really, even in hindsight, regardless of how many times you've read it, it's just shocking to what they're able to accomplish in those 15 months.
Yeah, if your listeners have a screen available or they have multiple screens like I do, they might want to bring up the West Point Atlas page and go to something called the West Point Military Atlas, as it's public domain, and then go to the World War II in the Pacific, and then go to something called the Centrifugal Offensives, which is a beautiful, beautiful sort of portrayal of what you're talking about with what I call the Oceanic Blitzkrieg. So I want to back up here a little bit and talk about two things. The first thing is you know, the aircraft carrier was a very contingent weapons system platform idea/concept. The impetus for aircraft carriers in World War I was not to go out and battle ships at sea. The idea was the British were going to create these carriers that could take the fight to the pens in Belgium and North Germany. And so they began converting battleships and one battlecruiser, the Furious, to go attack these things. Well, the war kind of ended before they'd actually proved their utility, but the British had quite a few of these. They led the world in aircraft carriers when the war ended. And by the time we get to the early 1920s, the British had like 8 aircraft carriers, most of them converted from other ships. The Japanese had one experimental carrier, the Hosho, and the United States had one experimental carrier, the Langley. But it got all captured into this idea of air power. And it's going to be ironic that the nation with the lead in aircraft carriers at the end of World War I, Great Britain, will actually be the nation that's furthest behind in aircraft carrier development when war comes in the 1930s, for Britain in 1939. For Japan, of course, in 1937, Japan will have already used aircraft carriers as power projection platforms against land targets as early as 1932. So the Japanese are the pros from Dover when World War II comes along in terms of employing aircraft carriers at least as power projection platforms. But people didn't know what these things were going to do so much. They kind of had to guess. You know, the Americans went down a track of aircraft carriers are going to provide air defense for the battle fleet. We agree to these treaties, we're going to limit the number of aircraft carriers we have, and pretty soon we learn that their role, that we don't really have enough of them to provide air defense for anything more than air defense, even though in the war period we come up with this thing called the scouting fleet, and we put the aircraft carriers in the scouting fleet, but we keep learning over and over again in our fleet exercises that battleships are very vulnerable to aircraft carriers, and so they need air defense. And so nobody really knows what these things can or cannot do. Early in the war, one of them gets sunk by German battle cruisers up off in Norway. The British lose a carrier to battle cruiser fire up off of Norway. So they are very, very vulnerable. And that's known prior to the war beginning in the Pacific. Well, at the same time, and I spend quite a bit of time when I do the World War II lecture for the Naval War College. I'm going to do one on Tuesday in Pensacola, by the way, World War II, the U.S. Navy in World War II. The Japanese do a really fine job developing their concept, but they use it for the wars that they end up in. And so if they're in a land war in Asia, they use their aircraft carriers to conduct a land war in Asia, kind of like we do in the War on Terror. Land wars in Asia in that case. So they're But they also have designed these things to sort of fleet, you know, command of the sea platform. But their main role is power projection and defense of the battle fleet. That's their main role in the Japanese Navy and in the U.S. Navy. And it makes perfect sense that their first major blow against the United States is not a fleet-on-fleet engagement. It's an engagement against a couple islands, you know, the Hawaiian Islands. And so this first big blow by aircraft carriers that the Japanese strike will be power projection, not fleet-on-fleet engagement. Yamamoto actually is very, very worried that the considerable air defenses that exist on Pearl Harbor we have the Pacific Air Forces there, the Army Air Force and the Navy Air Force, that the carriers will be discovered. He's very worried that land-based air is going to sink at least a third of his carriers, and that's his estimate for the Pearl Harbor after he's decided, you know, if we get out of this with one-third of our aircraft carriers sunk, we'll be lucky, okay? And so when he gets out of it without any of them being sunk, he basically has a party back there on his flagship, the Nagato. He's not on the Yamato yet. He's still on the battleship Nagato, which is not part of the Pearl Harbor raiding force. So the aircraft carrier was an unknown quantity. The knowns about the aircraft carrier was that it was a really good strike, power projection platform in an environment where the other guy didn't have any navies, or where the other guy was sleeping, as in Pearl Harbor, right? So that's kind of that, and I go into that in the book. The other piece is the Oceanic Blitzkrieg. I had come up with this a number of years ago, over 20 years ago. I looked at a map of the Japanese offensives, and I'm just going to make this analogy, and then I'm going to let you guys kind of tease me some more questions. And the Japanese attacks looked a heck of a lot like what the Germans did on the Eastern Front against the Russians in 1941, about 6 months earlier, in fact, in June of 1941. So you have these major offensives, except in the Japanese case, they're on land, air, and sea. In the German case, it was air and land, but it was the same direction going east. And it was the same way. They had efforts to the south. They had efforts to the north. They had efforts down the Central Pacific. And the Japanese did the Germans one better. They went west as well into Thailand and Burma towards India. So just these incredible offensives. And the movement, trying to follow the movements of the Japanese Navy in this time period, the first 6 months of the Japanese expansion of the war in the Pacific against the United States, the Netherlands, and Great Britain it dizzies the mind. You know, that's why I sent your listeners to the centrifugal offensives, just to show them just this incredible reach and movement of these naval forces, and not just the aircraft carriers, the entire combined fleet. You know, and John Parcell got captured by this idea, 40 years ago, or however old John is. I don't know, maybe he's younger than that. And it fascinated him so much he has a web page, combined fleet, that he does, and then he wrote a whole battle on Midway about it. He's so fascinated with this Japanese fleet that can move and strike all these blows in such a vast fashion. But I always thought the similarity between the blitzkrieg against the Soviet Union and the blitzkrieg against the Americans, the British, and the Netherlands bore so many things in common with each other in terms of it. And of course, in the Japanese case, the distances are almost triple of what they were for the Germans against the Soviets, quadruple in some cases, just these vast, vast distances.
Well, at some point, I think you talk about the shift in the United States. I mean, first, the U.S. had to defend, had to build up. And we had, I think at the time, after Pearl Harbor, we had three carriers, if I'm not mistaken, in the Pacific. Maybe four. I can't remember exactly. But and we wanted to, we were, since we had lost most of our, at least temporarily lost our battleships, it was pretty clear, I would think, to the to Nimitz when he took over, maybe to Kimmel before he, before he left, that, that we were suddenly dependent on the aircraft carrier for a lot of things. Talk a little bit about the need to preserve those and preserve the logistics train that was keeping them and any of the other ships out at sea.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of new scholarship on this, but the source that I used was Ernest King's reports to the Secretary of the Navy to kind of set things up for the approach. And once, remember, when the Japanese attack us on December 7th and then he attacked the British and the Dutch and the Thais on December the 8th, and of course us in the Philippines, the strategy has already been decided by something called the American-British Conversations, which occurred secretly in Washington, D.C., the year before in 1940-41. And that decision was codified in a memorandum called the Plan Dog Memo, which was fed to the people who were doing something called the Rainbow Plans. And so so Europe was first. Certainly when the Germans attacked Russia, the Europe first strategy became even more solidified, you know, that we were going to use Lend-Lease, the arsenal of democracy for the Russians and for the Soviets and for the British and anybody else who wanted to fight the Germans. So the strategy was already decided. That strategy, of course, was put into crisis by the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor. And so now we have some decisions to make. But Admiral King, not yet Chief of Naval Operations, is the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet, recently promoted from Commander of the Atlantic Fleet to Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet. And King describes to the Secretary that we have to defend first. And he divides the Pacific War up into four phases: the defense, the defense offense, where he's going to use what forces he has as an active defense, offensively, using defensive forces actively to kind of keep the Japanese off of balance, but not really to go on the offensive. And then he'll use something called the offense-defense, and then he'll have the offense-offense. And so he divides the war up into those sort of phases. The other thing that he makes clear for the Secretary to know, and which was well understood in the Navy at the time, but it's King who's pushing this down to his commanders, especially Chester Nimitz, when he takes over at Pearl Harbor, is this idea of calculated risk. Trent Hones talked a lot about this in his work, particularly his recent work, Mastering the Art of Command, which is on Nimitz and what he's doing in the Pacific War. But it's King, and it's well understood throughout the Navy, and this is the idea that we're not going to gamble our naval assets, but we will risk them if there's the opportunity to perhaps do more damage to the enemy than he can do to us. But this has got to be calculated. You can't lose precious assets willy-nilly. And initially, the Doolittle raid, which is something that Nimitz is that King is excited about, kind of violates King's guidance. And Nimitz is actually against the Doolittle raid. So that first period after Pearl Harbor is the period of the carrier raids. But Nimitz actually doesn't like the fact that King and Doolittle and Halsey but King's really the father of it, are gonna risk two of these very, very important aircraft carriers in kind of a crazy raid on Japan to kind of boost American morale and the sort of proof of concept, you know, with these precious aircraft carriers. When Pearl Harbor is struck, there are only three aircraft carriers in the Pacific. One of those carriers is the Saratoga, who's getting her overhaul and having her 8-inch guns removed, by the way. Saratoga is not even anywhere near Pearl Harbor. The other two aircraft carriers are out are on a war footing already. One of them is going to Wake Island to beef up the defenses of Wake Island with the Marine aviators and supplies, and the other one is pushing in aviation and supplies into Midway. And so the Lexington and the Enterprise that's what they're doing when war comes. The other four aircraft carriers will probably shock your readers to know are Europe first. One of them, the Wasp, is ferrying aircraft to Malta in the Mediterranean. You know, I've always thought, what would happen if the Wasp had gotten plugged by a U-boat, you know, doing this mission in the Mediterranean? So, and then the other carriers are just coming online, and those are going to be the Yorktown, the Hornet, and the Ranger. And the Ranger will never come over to the Pacific. The Ranger will stay. Eventually, Wasp, Hornet, and Yorktown will all come over to the Pacific through the Suez Canal, or not the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal. They're designed to go. They're not so big that they can't get through the Panama Canal, so they were designed deliberately so that they could move between the fleets. So the United States is on the defense with its carriers, and the first carrier raids do cause the Japanese concerns, and they follow King's guidance of calculated risk. Aside from the Doolittle raid, which I argue is very important, it has an outsized impact. It causes the approval of a harebrained scheme that Yamamoto has been trying to get approved, but which the Army and the Navy Imperial General Staff have been vetoing as you know, a bridge too far, and that's this plan to take Hawaii, to eliminate the U.S. fleet once and for all. And Yamamoto is frantic. He realizes the Americans have decided to go ahead and fight anyway without their battle line. They're using the task forces built around aircraft carriers to power projection in the Pacific against the Japanese advance on one of their main lines of advance. The Japanese have three main lines of advance going on in the Pacific after Pearl Harbor. One is to the south to capture the oil and the resources of the Dutch and British East Indies. One of them is driving into Burma to threaten Britain's cash cow and the engine of the British economy that's kind of keeping Britain in the war, both with manpower and resources, and that's India. And then the third one is to cut off the strategic sea line of communication between the United States and Australia. And where Nimitz is doing the most damage is on that third leg that's driving down New Guinea and the Solomons and the Bismarcks to try to cut the sea line of communication with Australia. And as if we needed any reminding, of course, Nagumo comes and hammers Darwin, Australia, with a carrier raid in March, April. But and Nimitz, in one attack, sinks a bunch of Japanese transports and actually his carriers under, I'm trying to remember who was in charge. I don't know if it was Lee Noyes yet. It wasn't Fletcher yet, but Fletcher was actually heading up a carrier task force under Yorktown. They actually fly over the Owen Stanley Mountains in New Guinea, sink a bunch of Japanese transports, and they shoot down all these Japanese airplanes. The first time the Japanese naval aviation, land-based naval aviation in this case, has actually given a bloody nose by American aircraft carriers. You talked about logistics. The list logistics fleet, as it turns out, is not the fleet it will become. We actually have a shortage of fast oilers. One of the reasons that we kind of leave the battleships behind is we don't have enough oilers for fast carrier task forces and battleships. Another myth is that there are no battleships after Pearl Harbor. This is nonsense. Within a month, we've got at least four battleships that can work and run. And we have battleships in the Atlantic that we could bring over if we want. We just don't have the fast oilers to oil these things. So Nimitz makes the decision, supported by King, to devote these precious fast oilers like the Neosho and the Cimarron and ships like this to supporting the fast carrier raids and of course, the doozy of the raid against Japan.
Yeah, it's amazing the amount of echoes of issues we have here in 2024 that they were experiencing right at the kickoff at war. And in the back of King and Nimitz and everybody else's mind, you know, they knew that by mid-1943, the decisions that were made 7 years ago to really invest in the two-ocean navy and to get the shipyards up and running and to cut steel would start to come to the front, but they still had a war to fight. And there's a to your book, there's a nice companion article I would recommend to the reader. They can just Google John's name, Kay, but it's titled Multi-Domain Operations in a Bygone Era, the Guadalcanal Campaign, August 42 to January of 43. And when people talk about what could possibly a war game, different scenarios today west of the international dayline, I think it's really important for them to look back at things. For instance, you start the article, not at the very beginning, but about a couple pages in, quote, the American carriers, as Admiral Fletcher had already pointed out, were under the same constraints and particularly vulnerable to Japanese submarines and land-based aircraft, unquote. The modern-day equivalent, the Chinese do have quite a few submarines, but it's the People's Liberation Army rocket forces and their aviation forces and a lot of their ballistic and cruise missiles and things. It's a similar threat. And then as you go through the campaign, you know, certain things pop up. In late August, the Enterprise is damaged. The submarine I-26 torpedoed the Saratoga. You have later on, the Hornet was sunk and the Enterprise was damaged again. And, of course, the Japanese forces are saying again. And by the time we got to the heart of the Guadalcanal campaign, there were not as many carrier assets that ideally you would want to operate with. Talk for a little bit about how the leaders we had at the time and changing out some leaders at the time were able to continue with the overall campaign, not having some of the assets that they would ideally want to have simply because of a little bit of bad luck at sea.
Yeah. So I use Guadalcanal as an example, and King doesn't do this in his report. He actually switches to the offensive, I think at Coral Sea or Midway, but I consider Coral Sea and Midway both sort of defensive victories. The guy in tactical command at both of these battles is a guy nobody remembers anymore, Frank Jack Fletcher, who earned a Navy Cross in World War I and earned a Medal of Honor fighting Mexican warlord troops in Mexico in 1914, I think. So and he's going to be the guy in the initial phases of Guadalcanal. But King characterizes King's characterization, I change it. This is the beginning of the American offense, and it's called the first offense for a reason. This is the first American offensive in the Pacific since the Japanese had brought the Americans into the battle. Till then, the Americans, the British, and the Dutch had all been on their heels, just kind of moving backwards as the Japanese took the Philippines, took the Indies, started to take most of New Guinea, got into Papua New Guinea, took the Bismarck Islands, started their way down the Solomon Islands. And so after Midway, King takes this risk, it's not a gamble, and throws in the 1st Marine Division Plus, so it's a Division Plus, in the Guadalcanal to secure an airfield. And it begins this fight. Over command of the sea in the southern Solomon Islands, which is at the very edge of the Japanese operational reach from their major base at Rabaul, very edge of the Americans' operational reach from their bases that they're developing in French territory in New Caledonia, in Noumea, which is in New Caledonia, and then Afepe, which is today Vanuatu, in the New Hebrides. So it's at the very edge of the operational reach for both the Japanese and the Americans. But the Americans take this thing on the offensive. The carrier forces are very much the same, but that big fleet you talked about is not going to really start to come online until the next year. And so we seize this airfield. We also seize a seaplane base, which actually was the initial objective, was to seize the seaplane base at Toulon, captured during the Battle of the Coral Sea. And so we send, Nimitz sends his most experienced commander of carriers in combat, not Spruance. Spruance is actually Nimitz's chief of staff. He sends Fletcher. And Fletcher's got strict guidance. No, don't risk these carriers. And so forever afterwards, because he pulled these things out for about a week after the Marines landed, everybody's kind of castigated him. But he comes back, and he gets torpedoed by a Japanese submarine for his trouble. Actually, before that happens, he fights another major carrier battle in the Eastern Solomons, which the Japanese think is a victory. They come away from the Battle of the Eastern Solomons just like they did at the Coral Sea, thinking, hey, the Americans don't have any aircraft carriers left. We've sunk them all. Now we can get rid of this American, regiment that's down at Guadalcanal. And this is the beginning of a Japanese tale of intelligence shortcomings, where they have no idea that we have this entire Marine division down there with enough rations, to make it by until the Americans can push another supply convoy through. At least for a month, the Marines have enough to keep them on maybe starvation rations, certainly way more than the Japanese have. And so begins this battle over this airfield called Henderson Field, a Marine aviator who was killed at Midway, and so they name it in honor of him. Every time an American carrier will go down, its air wing will fly into Henderson Field and become part of what's called the Cactus Air Force. By the time we get to September, there are three different air forces at Henderson Airfield. The Marines with their Marine Air, the Navy with the Navy Air, mostly carrier aviators who are now on a unsinkable aircraft carrier named Henderson Field, and Army aviators will start flying in P-39 Aerocobras that will become part of the Air Force. In the daytime, the Japanese will be unable to operate in the waters around Guadalcanal. At the nighttime, the Americans will be unable to operate in the waters around Guadalcanal because of the Japanese surface night fighting tactics. And they'll deliver a stinging defeat at Savo Island early in the campaign, and then another bloody battle at Cape Esperance, where it's more of a tie, but still very, very bloody. And so you get this battle. Airplanes don't fly at night back then. And so the Americans control the seas by day because they have land-based air, not really carrier air. And by the time we get to the end of October, the Americans don't have any carriers left. The Japanese themselves are starting to run out of ships too. And the Japanese keep trying to capture the airfield, but they keep losing these battles. They lose a battalion level force in the beginning of the campaign, then they essentially are defeated with a brigade attack on the airfield in September, and then in October they try a corps level attack, which is completely unsynchronized with the Navy attack from truck, and so you have the Japanese coming down with invasion force from truck to support the Army, but the Navy force attacks early and is defeated at the Battle of Santa Cruz Island, where the Hornet is sunk and the Enterprise damaged. And so now it's just the Marines and their Air Force against the Japanese and their surface ships that are trying to supply the Japanese Army to take the base. And you get these bloody battles in November called the Naval Battles of Guadalcanal, where ironically the ship that kind of seals the doom of the Japanese garrison in Guadalcanal will be the radar-equipped battleships under Willis Lee. And they'll break the back of the Japanese Navy and its attempt to desperately reinforce. When it's all said and done and the sun comes up after 4 days of day, night, land fighting at Guadalcanal in the middle of November, the Marines, the Navy aviators, and the Army aviators will control the seas around Guadalcanal, and the Japanese will make the decision to withdraw their forces from Guadalcanal and let the Americans have it. So this is a six-month all-out battle. It'll go on for another month as the Japanese withdraw to the northern end of the island to retreat and pull their forces out. And by the way, they will pull out somewhere around 7,000 to 8,000 Japanese soldiers at night using the Tokyo Express in the face of the American Navy, because we just don't have the combat power to prevent them from doing it. So it's a very desperate fight, but it's an American win. Fletcher loses his job because he gets wounded on the Saratoga, and Slew McCain, who's commanding the land base there, is also given a break. So too, and then the Navy overall commander, Robert Gormley, will be fired and removed from command and replaced with Halsey. But Halsey's going to have precious few aircraft carriers to do this fight. He's going to be mostly using surface ships and airplanes, land-based airplanes, including Army B-17s from the FEDE to kind of contest this operation. And it becomes very much of a close-run thing. An amazing fight. I just want to tell your readers one thing. If they go to look for the article that Sal mentioned, that Commander Salamander mentioned, they're probably going to find that they have to be a student at CGSOC to get at the article. They might be able to get access to it because it is posted on Blackboard for the Navy students and the Army students here. But it's an unpublished reading for the students. So I'm sorry, that article on Guadalcanal multi-domain campaign, it's based on the same research, though, that I wrote the chapter for the book on this. People go to the book, they can get pretty much the same sort of stuff, not quite the same thing because it is different, but the book does have a chapter that deals with Guadalcanal. I'm trying to go up to it right now and tell them which chapter it is. Yeah, I think this defense to offense, I think that's it's either chapter 3 or chapter 4, maybe chapter 4.
Yeah, as I was reading through the book, I was struck by how Admiral Wiley and his analysis of how we strategy. The concept of the sequential and what's the other word?
Cumulative.
Cumulative. There you go. Yeah, sure. I knew that. It's pretty well laid out in your book. I mean, it was kind of forced, I think, by the nature. And of course, Wiley has the benefit of hindsight because he's looking at it after the war. But we turn the subs loose to engage in unrestricted warfare, and then we start moving along as we had to do to capture these outlying areas until we could get close to the homeland. Kind of talk about that a little bit. Is it just King's genius that he saw this ahead of time, or is Wiley just reflecting what actually happened and is not really
scholarship, it's hard to find consensus on the reasons for the success in the Pacific. Trent Hone has provided some really good answers when he talks about this in Learning War, that the Navy is a learning organization. But again, it's a learning organization with an immense industrial base behind it. So if you're going to fight an attritional war with the United States, at least back then, not a good idea, right? But on top of it, there is good leadership, but it's systems of systems. I mean, it's like one of the French captains said after Trafalgar. At Trafalgar, every British captain was a Nelson. Well, in the Navy, you have a lot of Nelsons and Kings and Nimitzes and Halseys and Spruances and Fletchers, and these guys all sort of follow sort of the same pattern, and they all sort of have the same view of warfare. I think does a good job of kind of showing you it's not just the Navy and the Marines. The Army plays a huge role in this. I mean, MacArthur wanted to do the first offensive. He told the Combined Chiefs of Staff and the JCS, listen, give me 2 weeks, give me the first Marines, and I'll kick the Japanese out of New Guinea, and I'll go capture Rabaul. Of course, everybody on the Joint Chiefs of Staff laughed at it, and they go, well, that's a crazy idea, and it'll take us, gosh, Rabaul won't even ever fall, but it'll take another year and a half to neutralize Rabaul. So MacArthur was, you know, doing some sort of, you know, tropical route or something down in Australia when he after that. But he does begin his offensive shortly after the Guadalcanal begins at Buna and Gona. And just like Guadalcanal, it's at the limits of his operational reach, and it's ugly. You know, it's the Americans don't have it their whole way. There are – the Pacific is the second priority, right? And Nimitz himself, or not Nimitz, but MacArthur's theater is, you know, even lower priority than Nimitz's South Pacific theater under Halsey. After Guadalcanal is over, MacArthur and Halsey develop a really good working relationship, and then MacArthur starts to build up his own naval forces. Eventually, they become the 7th Fleet under Kincaid, and he fights a series of just really dazzling operational campaigns up New Guinea, across to Cape Gloucester on the island of New Britain, which is where Rabaul is. At the same time, Halsey is fighting another campaign up the Solomons. And so Halsey and MacArthur are the original dual advance, with Halsey going up the Solomons to New Georgia and Bougainville, supported by, you know, the Navy. And Nimitz actually, his offensive in the Central Pacific doesn't really get started till late 1943 with Tarawa. And then Nimitz has his brilliant campaigns in the Marshalls and in the Carolines. Well, not really in the Carolines. He doesn't. Some people would say Eniwetok is really in the Marshalls, and it's not in the Carolines. You know, the fascinating thing here is they figure out how to kind of make Japan's defense on interior lines at the strategic and operational level a drawback, not an advantage. You know, the idea is that Kido Butai and the Japanese carriers and fleet would be able to run around on interior lines and defeat these offensives in turn. But the problem is Yamamoto, Japanese fleet that's in Rabaul, and the Imperial Navy General Staff have got to meet three major offensives at the same time, and they simply don't have aircraft carriers, the aircraft, and the Army troops to do it. In fact, the Army goes to the Navy and says, you lied to us. You're telling us you need more troops to defend these islands, but we've got a war in China that we're bogged down in, and we really don't have any troops to give you. You kind of lied to us about, you know, what it was going to take to beat the Americans. And so, you know, on the American side, everybody's working together. On the Japanese side, everybody's dysfunctional. And each time the Japanese think they have it figured out where the next blow is going to land, you know, the Americans land in Tarawa and seize the Gilberts. And they go, okay, well, let's focus there. And then, boom, you know, MacArthur lands in Cape Nassau and it lands Salamua. And then, boom, Halsey shows up in Bougainville. And, you know, and the Japanese just can't get their balance. And the problem is now they're in the worst form of warfare that they wanted to fight, which is an attrition war. And the Americans keep showing up with more and better troops. Almost from mid-1943 on, the Americans will almost always have command of the air and local command of the sea in these fights, and the Japanese won't. And it'll be very difficult for them. The only time where they really make an effort to kind of get it back will be in the Battle of the Philippine Sea, where they kind of try to get back command of the air and sea, and it backfires on them. They have something called a decisive battle doctrine. And so when Nimitz's Central Pacific campaign shows up in the Marianas, and this is going to be Operation Forager, the Japanese just aren't ready for it. They're thinking that they're going to, you know, launch their carrier airplanes, then they'll go on a one-way trip and fly into the bases in Guam, Tinian, and Saipan. Well, the Americans shoot down all the Japanese land-based air forces before the Japanese fleet even shows up, and then if they're flying into land in these bases, the Americans already dominate the air, and then they have the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot. And so the Japanese suffer these horrendous losses of these precious carrier but it's taken them almost 9 months to together enough to kind of attack the Americans. And so you get this. So the Japanese have this decisive battle. They have to lose it, and they keep losing it. They'll lose it again at Tennessee, where I'm going here, that they kind of keep losing the decisive battle, and they go, well, next time we'll get them, you know, next time we'll get them. And they take it all the way to the end of the war with Okinawa, where they again, are the Americans, you know, getting off lightly in these battles? No, they're suffering, but they're just slowly strangling Japan with air and sea and land power. And the Japanese are starting to run out of options.
I'm curious your opinion on something that the older I get, the more I agree with, is when, you know, we talk about attritional warfare, and especially when you think about the industrial age of warfare, and it's also easier to put up on a slide, so to speak, numbers of ships, numbers of aircraft, the aircraft carriers' losses. But one thing that really, during the latter part of the war, seemed to be an even greater problem with the Japanese, and I'm curious where you'd put the balance here. It's not so much the fact, like in Midway, that they lost all those carriers, but they lost all of the most experienced aviators they had, which gave them that comparative advantage at the opening of the war. And so it wasn't just the material and industrial attrition, but the Japanese never seemed to get off the back foot when it came to having their air wings led and experienced on the level that the Americans just kept sending from CONUS.
Yeah, the Japanese training, and Mark Petey goes into this in a great book called Sunburst, which is the history of the Japanese naval aviation. It's very much like his book with Dave Evans, Kaigon, but Sunburst tells the story of Japan, and they come up with this grueling training program to train the most elite naval aviators in the world. Japan in 1941 has the best naval aviation force in the world, both land-based and sea-based. I mean, they sink the Prince of Wales and the Repulse with land-based torpedo bombers, and it's like they didn't even break a sweat when they did it. But they don't have the programs to train these guys for the long durée, and then when the war gets desperate, as at Guadalcanal, they can't pull these guys out of the line. I mean, we're pulling guys out of the line like Jimmy Thatch and Flatley and Butch O'Hare to train guys back in the United States, because we have this huge 100-carrier fleet coming, and we cycle guys out of the line. The Japanese don't do that. They won't bring their guys back. And then they run into the problem of not only don't they have the veterans anymore, but now they don't have the gas to train these guys because we're sinking all their oilers. They have to divide their fleet with the carriers up in Japan and the battleships and the surface ships down in Lingo Road in Singapore, because they don't have the oil anymore because we sink all of their oil tankers in the avgas. And so the Japanese ironically end up where the Germans are in mid-1944. A new pilot's first combat mission will be his last mission. The only guys that are surviving are the few, the few that are left. You know, I forget, there was a Stuka pilot who wrote a book called, you know, The First and the Last. I think it was, I forget his name. But anyway, that was the Japanese and the German Luftwaffe are very much alike. They just don't have the pilots to compete anymore. And that's because they hadn't foreseen that this was going to be a war of attrition in the air. You know, we sort of stumbled into this in the German campaign. We sort of stumbled into this Achilles heel for the Luftwaffe. We don't. In the Pacific, Slew McCain, in the midst of the Guadalcanal campaign, writes back, and he's the commander of COM Air SOPAC, Commander Air Forces South Pacific, the land-based air forces, and he writes back to King saying, hey, we can turn Guadalcanal into the sinkhole for Japanese aviation. And we do. And we basically do it throughout the Pacific. And it becomes a case of where the Japanese have to resort to these desperate measures of kamikazes, ketsugos, bonka boats, suicide boats, all the kind of things we're seeing today. you know, are basically sort of, you know, I mean, I hate to use this because it's not really, they're unmanned, unguided systems. Well, the Japanese don't have that luxury in 1944, so they go with manned guided systems, right? Because the man is the guidance system. And so it's a fascinating story. It's a tragic story, too, because this is a superb force that Japan takes to war. But by the time we get to the end, very few of them are alive.
Yeah, I like the first quote at the conclusion, in the conclusion you wrote, which is from Admiral King. The war has been variously termed a war of production and a war of machines, whatever else it is. As far as the United States is concerned, it's a war of logistics. And, you know, you just hit on that. We sank their oilers. Well, that interrupted their ability to train new aviators. We were cutting off their supplies to make new aircraft. And, yeah, I mean, that spells the doom. I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned to that if we have to go to war again in the Pacific. It's, you know, the logistics is key. But let's talk a little bit about what, you know, this book, I highly recommend people read this. It's not a very long book, but it's dense. And
Naval Institute wouldn't let me make it longer. They wouldn't let me add an epilogue to it. That's how short they wanted it to be. I wrote another 4 pages, and they couldn't even put that in the book.
The advantage of that, though, John, is that people, you know, they will read a shorter book. If you pick up Mahan's, History of Sea Power, that's an intimidating book for a lot of people. So while we're talking about this, so what are you working on now? What can we look forward to next to seeing out of your fertile mind?
Well, I've got some chapters coming out in some new books that are going to be coming out. One of them is with Naval Institute Press. It's a book on fleets and being, edited by Sally Payne. So I've got a chapter on fortified fleets and being there, talking about actually the British Navy and the Dutch Navy and what they were doing early in the Pacific War and prior to it in terms of how they wanted to defend. So so that'll be in an analogy, in an anthology that's coming out. I'm working on a paper right now. I'm going to present in April at the Society of Military History, and it's like Monty Python now for something completely different. It's going to be on Mark Bristol, Lieutenant Commander commanding the Newport Torpedo Station in 1908 to 1910-11. And that's because I'm fascinated by this guy Bristol. He's not a World War II admiral, but he was our first ever ambassador to Turkey while he was an active duty admiral, and he also commanded the gunboats in China as the commander of the Asiatic Fleet and was on the general board. So this was kind of a spinoff in my interest in Admiral Bristol and him commanding the Newport Torpedo Station. I hope to eventually publish that at some point, but one of the archives there, Stacy Perilla and I were talking about, you know, the Newport Torpedo Station. Today it sounds like, oh, yeah, very boring torpedo station, you know, prior to World War I. But it was like Silicon Valley. I mean, it was right at the center of all this advanced, innovative technology like wireless telegraphy and periscope optics and submarines and unguided systems like torpedoes. And this guy was right here in the middle of it with all of these crazy inventions and machines and everything. So that's coming up at Society of Military History. That'll be up in Washington at Arlington when they have their conference there. And then the next book project I have, it's with Naval Institute Press, but I pitched it to him. It's Mask of Naval Command, kind of modeled on John Keegan's Mask of Command. I don't have a contract or anything for that. Right now it's just a book proposal, so I'm just kind of waiting to hear on that.
Well, I'm really interested in the Newport torpedo station. It's those little out of the direct view corner little stories that I think are really enlightening. So yeah, I look, you'll have to send me a link when that becomes publicly available. That seems really interesting.
I have to give you a preview on it. So Bristol takes over this outfit and takes command, and shortly after he gets there and takes command, a submarine comes to report for duty, and it's the USS Plunger. It's one of the brand new first-generation American submarines, and it comes in to get its torpedoes tested and also to assist with research and development on torpedo systems for submarines. And the commander of the Plunger is Chester W. Nimitz, Ensign W. Nimitz. So I love this stuff.
It's always been a small Navy. You never know who you're going to run into. And John, we really appreciate you coming on for this Super Bowl Sunday. It's been a great conversation. I look forward to the next time.
Yeah, I loved it, Sal. Eagle One, you guys are great. Go Chiefs.
Yeah, get ready to put your gear on. Get that face paint going, John.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Mid-Rats. Until next time, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Goodbye.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy Old, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.